I don't know about you, but I've been really enjoying our series in the book of Daniel over these last few weeks. I think I found them really challenging, particularly the last couple of weeks, really encouraging. So just thinking about what it's like, or what it should be like to live against the flow in every area of our life. And I've really enjoyed the series so far. And we've come to chapter 5 of the book of Daniel. So in our series, this Against the Flow, you can see on the screen, Against the Flow, we're looking through the first 7 chapters of this book of Daniel. And the way that they're set up is that chapters 4 and 5 are really, really the key. Almost the heart of this section of Daniel. Really fascinating section of the book of Daniel. So I just want to take you through, just kind of by way of kind of remembering, kind of revision of what we've done so far, but just to make the point that what we're going to be looking at today and what we looked at last week is really central to everything that we're doing in this series. So chapter 1, you can flick back to chapter 1 if you want to. It's on page 737 in one of the church Bibles, if you can get one. But chapter 1 is really interesting. It's written, just like almost all of the whole Old Testament, in a language called Hebrew. So the language of Israel, Hebrew, and it's written there. And really chapter 1 sets up the tension that we've seen all the way through the book so far. Chapter 1 sets up the tension. Well, who really is in charge? You've got God's people being carted off to Babylon. And the question, the tension is, well, so which God's in charge? Is it the God of Israel? Or is it the gods of Babylon? Who's really in charge? And that's something which we've seen already over these last few weeks. But the chapters 2 to 7 are written, interestingly, in a different language. So it's not Hebrew, the language of Jerusalem. Chapters 2 to 7 is written really in a global language called Aramaic. It was kind of the language of most of the world at the time. So chapters 2 to 7 is its own section. And there's real symmetry in what we've seen so far, what we're going to see in the next couple of weeks. So think back to chapter 2 a few weeks ago, and then what we'll see in a couple of weeks, chapter 7, they go together. Chapters 2 and chapter 7 go together. There'll be a terrible slide on the back. That says Daniel 2, that's a Daniel 7, and there was a line in between. So Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 are very, very closely linked. They're both about a vision or about a dream about four earthly kingdoms, plus God's eternal kingdom that'll last forever. So chapter 2 we saw a few weeks ago, chapter 7 we'll see in a couple of weeks' time. They're really linked with that idea. Then chapters 3 and chapter 6 link as well. This idea of trials, of worship, and of deliverance. So a couple of weeks ago, we saw the furnace. Next week, I don't want to give too much away for next week, but don't tell anyone, but next week there were lions, okay? Andy is going to be preaching, and I can't say for sure, but I can't definitely say that he's not going to bring a lion with him, okay? I can't rule it out completely, so just come and see what he does. But the idea of chapters 3 and chapter 6, just that idea of kind of a worship trial and of deliverance, which leaves, you'll see kind of where the next things are going, chapters 4 and chapter 5, kind of form kind of the middle kind of pivot of this thing. It kind of goes in and goes back out. And we saw last week, and we'll see this week, we meet two kings that are humbled, two proud kings that are humbled. And the question that is asked, particularly in chapter 4 and chapter 5, is, well, who's king? See how that links back with the theme that started in chapter 1. Who really is king? Who is really in charge? And that's how this section of Daniel, this series of Daniel against the flow, that's how it works. And so we've come today to chapter 5, which is on page 742. Chapter 4 and chapter 5, as I said, are really the heart of this section of the book of Daniel. Really fascinating chapter. And the issue is, again, who's in charge? And we're thinking about being against the flow. So living against the flow, living against the one who looks like he's in charge, but living for the one who really is in charge. Who is really in charge? But the issue, I think, fundamentally, even below that issue of who's in charge, the issue really in these chapters 4 And today in chapter 5, the issue really is pride. Now, pride isn't just one of the seven deadly sins, if that was your first thought that went in your head. Pride is the root of all sin, of every sin, of all the sins that we do. And when I say pride, I guess what I mean by that is me making everything about me. I think that's pride. I'm in charge. I'm the captain. I'm the king of the castle. That's pride. Now, in real life, in kind of the normal week, I'm probably not going to be as blatant as that. I'm not going to go around saying outwardly to people, I'm the king of the castle, and, you know, kind of push people away. I'm not going to do that because I don't think I'm that blatant. But maybe you know what this is like. Maybe if you're doing something that's kind, maybe even you're doing something that's humble, do you ever have that thought that goes in the back of your head thinking, oh, real man, I really hope they notice me being humble? Have you ever thought that? If I ever do something humble or kind, I'm always, there's like a nagging thing that says, oh, is there a way to be humble a bit louder? Is there a way I can make it a bit obvious? So if someone writes the movie of my life, this bit is going to be in it because I'm being really humble and super. Do you know what that's like? Maybe that's just me. You know, you're kind of laughing, but like, maybe that's just me. That's, you know, pride looks like lots of different things. And it's basically, it's just me, isn't it? It's pride. I is at the center. Me, up, up, up. I'm the king of the castle. And for all of us, that is completely normal. That's how really we live our day, isn't it? That's how our neighbors live. That's how our work colleagues live. That's just normal for us. Me, up, up, up. I'm the king of the castle. That is completely normal. But God isn't a fan at all. God is not a fan of that kind of pride. And Daniel chapter 5, if you're up for it, will kind of show us why that is the case. So Daniel chapter 5, as I said, if you want to follow along, it's on page 742. It starts like all the other chapters. It starts with a man who's clearly in charge. So have a look at verse 1. Chapter 5, verse 1. King Belshazzar, that's how I'm going to pronounce it. My pronunciation might change. Don't kind of be distracted too much by that. But King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. Now, immediately, there's a question. Immediately, I think the question is, well, who is this new guy, King Belshazzar? We've had King Nebuchadnezzar for 4 weeks as we've gone through Daniel. And now suddenly we've got this King Belshazzar. Who is he? Well, for centuries, he only existed in Daniel chapter 5. Well, really, for more than a few centuries, the only place he existed is in the sentence, the chapter that I've just read. And because he didn't exist anywhere else, Daniel must have made him up. And you can't really trust people or books that make other people up, can you? This is a huge problem for Christians through the centuries, a huge problem for the Bible. Belshazzar just didn't exist. Must have made him up. That was until in the 1880s. So however many years ago that was, the 1880s, someone found some Babylonian cylinders. Kind of, well, I think there's a picture. There you go. There is the actual one that they found. That is taken from the British Museum website. You can find all about it on the British Museum or on Wikipedia. But they found that, and on it, you can maybe see, make out some of the writing. That writing was done by or on behalf of a king of Babylon who they knew existed. And in it, he talks about his son. Can you guess what his son's called? Belshazzar. So suddenly, Belshazzar exists. So it's kind of just as a little aside, but it's a really important, slight tangent, but a really important tangent is to say that the Bible really is trustworthy. God really can be trusted with the details of history. For centuries, King Belshazzar didn't exist, and people would throw that in the face of Christians. Well, you can't really trust the Bible, can you? Because look, it talks about this king, and he doesn't exist. And in the 1880s, someone says, oh, look, there he is. God really can be trusted with the details of history. So what's the deal then with King Belshazzar? What is his deal? Well, the historical details you kind of have to like piece together, and it's quite fun to do that if you are a fan of history and that kind of thing. But it seems to have been So chapter 5 seems to have happened, there seems to be about 20 years after King Nebuchadnezzar has died. So King Nebuchadnezzar dies, about 20 years have gone by. There's been about four kings in those 20 years, and King Belshazzar, who's Nebuchadnezzar's descendant, his grandson most likely, has been king for 14 of those 20 years. Now, the king, King Belshazzar was what's called a co-regent of Babylon. So his dad, his father, kind of was the boss of the whole area, but he lived in Arabia, so not really that close to Babylon at all. So he'd left his son, King Belshazzar, in charge. So King Belshazzar really was the king of Babylon. That's how it worked. So Daniel chapter 5, we have a king in charge who's the same family as Nebuchadnezzar, and exactly the same problem that we've seen in Nebuchadnezzar throughout all these chapters. And that problem is pride. Again, look back at those first few verses. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Israel be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood and stone. That must have been some party. The king with 1,000 of his lords, 1,000 of his subjects, eating and drinking, mostly drinking, it seems. But there's something quite sinister going on. It wasn't like a nice party to be at, I don't think, if we were there. Something sinister. This feast, this party, was much more of a declaration of authority, a declaration of who really is in charge. Because while the party was going on, everybody knew that there was an army, a Persian army, outside the city, happening at the same time. This big party, 1,000 of the lords and ladies and all these people and the king having this feast, and outside the walls, this Persian army trying to get in. But also what everybody knew was that the walls of Babylon were indestructible. There was no way that this army was going to get in. Babylon was completely safe. So they had a feast, they had a party. They celebrated, you know, this special feast day because they knew they were safe. Belshazzar had supreme confidence in Babylon's main god, a god called Bel. Bel had made Babylon great, and Bel would keep Babylon safe. Belshazzar's name proves it. You know what Belshazzar means? Belshazzar means, may Bel protect the king. When you've got Bel on your side, there's nothing to worry about, is there? Nothing to worry about at all. Bel was the best. Bel was the biggest. And for some reason, King Belshazzar wanted to rub it into the God of Israel's face. So you can picture the scene. They've been drinking, they've been eating, and they've been drinking a bit more. And he just declares, look, get the Jewish God's cups. Get them out of storage, get them out of the museum, get them from wherever they are, get them from out the cupboards. Get the Jewish God's cups, bring them here, fill them with wine, and we're going to have a toast. These cups that would have been used to remember the God of Israel by Israel, by the Jews. And King Belshazzar is using them to toast, not the God of Israel. What does he toast? He toasts the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. To the real God, Bel. To Bel. Everyone's drinking. To this God over here. To this God. Yeah, great, good choice. That's what they were doing. But their cheers suddenly gave way to fear. Their happiness turned to horror, and their drinking turned to dread. The king was suddenly, out of nowhere, no longer in control. Have a look at verse 5. Immediately, so in the middle of those cheers, in the middle of the toasts, immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed, His thoughts alarmed him, his limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. It's kind of a weird phrase, isn't it? Your knees knocking together. Maybe you kind of know about what that feels like. Maybe you, at some point you've been so overcome by fear or dread that maybe your knees haven't literally knocked together, but they've come close. Just pure fear. For Belshazzar, literally the writing was on the wall. And the king was desperate to know what it meant. So the king's top advisors come in, his religious gurus come back in. We've seen them, we've seen Nebuchadnezzar's gurus a few times, haven't we? And they're always a bit kind of slow. But the top advisors, the gurus come in to the feast, and they were offered wealth and power and position. And all they had to do to get all those things was just to read the writing on the wall and to explain what it meant. But none of them could do it. The letters, I think, were recognizable. They were lit up. They were by the lampstand like a spotlight. Everyone could see the letters, but no one could explain them. They made no sense. Imagine the king is kind of not just inside scared, but he's kind of even more, he's kind of visibly, physically in fear. So next, the queen comes in. That's from verse 10. And onwards, the queen. So perhaps the queen coming in, perhaps that's Belshazzar's mum. So the queen mother. Perhaps it's his grandma. So that would have been probably Nebuchadnezzar's wife, maybe. We're not sure who that is. But whoever that queen is, she comes in and she has a plan. She comes in and she has a very important solution. And her plan is quite simple. It's this. Keep calm. And get Daniel. Keep calm and get Daniel. She remembers Daniel from 20 years ago. She knows Daniel. She knows his real name. Notice she calls him Daniel. Back in chapter 1, Daniel was given a new name, which is referred to briefly in this paragraph. But she knows him as Daniel. She knows him. She remembers him. And just like us, she knows what he can do. Keep calm and get Daniel. So Daniel comes in. You can imagine him walking through the crowd, walking through these 1,000 people that have kind of suddenly sobered up, walking past the queen, walking up to the king. Again, just as an aside, I wonder how old you imagine Daniel to be. I think whenever I imagine Daniel, especially as I was thinking about this and imagine him walking into the room, I always imagine him to be like a teenager, like in chapter 1, or at least my age, because I'm close to being a teenager. So I imagine Daniel walking in, and he basically looks like me. But actually, Daniel chapter 1 was 60 years ago. So in Daniel chapter 1, Daniel came to Babylon as a teenager. And Daniel chapter 5 is about 60 years later. See, Daniel's not a kid anymore. Daniel is in his 70s. If Daniel was here, he would be far and away the oldest person in this room. That's a little aside, but I always found that quite interesting. But he comes in mid-70s, somewhere in his 70s, mid to late 70s. And he comes to the king. And the king offers Daniel the same. He offers Daniel all the power, all the wealth, all the position that the king was in power to do. He says, look, I'll give you royal status, this kind of purple robe. You'll be third in command after my dad, after me. You'll be the next important person, next most important person. You'll be third in command. Just tell me what this means. Daniel, I imagine, takes one look at the king. He takes one look at the writing, and he delivers a clear message from God, from verse 17. Daniel answered and said before your king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit was hardened, so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. That's a great summary of what we saw last week in chapter 4, isn't it? Nebuchadnezzar was the greatest king of the round, greatest king around of the land. The most powerful man on the planet. He was the king of the castle. He was the top of the tree until God humbled him and brought him low. Until Nebuchadnezzar realized eventually that the Most High God was in charge. There is a Most High God, and he is the source of everything. That was the lesson Nebuchadnezzar learned in chapter 4. That's the lesson that we saw Nebuchadnezzar learning last week. And none of that was a surprise to King Belshazzar. It's really interesting. Everything that Daniel has just said is not new information. I say that because of the next couple of verses. Have a look. So verse 22 and 23. These really are the key verses of this chapter. So if you can make a note of that, if you want to, I think these are probably the key verses in chapter 5. And you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. Belshazzar was on the throne. He was totally in control, totally confident. If ever there was someone who deserved to live me, 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 and up, 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 if there was anyone deserving of the title, I'm the king of the castle, it was King Belshazzar. But just like us, he knew Nebuchadnezzar's testimony, but he ignored it. It was almost like he was saying, well, my grandfather trusted this Yahweh, this God of Israel. Okay. But I don't need him. He's absolutely nothing to me. So instead, King Belshazzar drank wine and spat in God's face, but he wasn't drinking anymore, was he? He wasn't drinking anymore. You, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all of this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and of gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath and whose are all your ways you have not honored. So then, from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed, and this is the writing that was inscribed: many, many tekel and parsin. This is the interpretation of the matter. Many, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. See, the writing on the wall were kind of currency words, words of value. Kind of like, you know, we'd have pounds, shillings, and pence a certain time ago, pound, shilling, and pence. But that was really the words. They were kind of currency words, words of value. There's a picture on the screen. This is a picture, not a photo, but this is Rembrandt's painting of the scene. It's a little bit cut off, but that's okay. So you see the writing, you can see the king. That's perhaps what it looked like. But you have those words, many or minor, which again was currency, but really means, has that meaning of something being counted, of being numbered. The next word, tekel or shekel, is something that's weighed. And then perez, which is the plural of parsin, which is half a something. So probably half a minor in this case. Perez, half a minor. Again, just has that idea of being split, of being divided, which is exactly what the interpretation that Daniel gives. He says, King, your days have been numbered and you've been found wanting, and so your kingdom is done. Just done. Because that very night there was a knock at the door. King Belshazzar's pride had caught up with him. The Persian army that was outside the city walls, they dammed the river, they walked across the river and just walked through the middle of the city and came and knocked on the door. And it says, verse 30, that very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, a Babylon king, was killed. Babylon the Great was over. Belshazzar was dead. Did Bel protect the king? Not so much. Instead, God's message and his judgment was proclaimed by Daniel. Do you know what Daniel's name means? It means God is my judge. May Bel protect the king. God is my judge. This whole kind of crazy episode, this whole writing on the wall, I think hinges on that end of the story. Because you see, pride will kill you. Pride will kill you because God is your judge. Chapters 4 and chapters 5 of Daniel are the heart of the book, the heart of the story. In chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar looked out over the Babylon Empire and declared, I'm the king of the castle. I'm the top of the tree. No one can touch me. In chapter 5, King Belshazzar toasted idols made of metal and stone, shaking his fist and daring God to do something about it. Both were full of pride. With every breath, in the words of Daniel, in every breath they lifted up themselves against the Lord. That's pride, full of pride. But one of those kings was humbled and saved. Nebuchadnezzar was humbled by the God Most High, by the real king, until he saw the truth about God, that everything comes from this Most High God, the God of Israel. But King Belshazzar knew that story. Maybe he was even around, kind of growing up, to see that story, but he knew what happened, but he refused to listen. He spent decades refusing to listen to Nebuchadnezzar's testimony, but he couldn't ignore the writing on the wall. Pride will kill you because God is your judge. But there is a way out. There is a way out. Over the last week or so, as I've been preparing for this message and just thinking, you know, about chapter 5 and how it fits in the book and kind of what it's all about, I've kept coming back to, kept thinking about a psalm, Psalm 2. See, Psalm 2 is about kings and rulers, about plots and plans. Psalm 2 is about a God in heaven who is really in charge. Psalm 2 is about pride and about judgment and about rescue. Psalm 2 is about Nebuchadnezzar and it's about Belshazzar and it's about me and it's about you. So I'm going to read the whole of Psalm 2. You can follow along if you want to. Let me just find the right page. Psalm 2, it's on page 448, but don't worry about following on because I'll read the whole thing. So Psalm chapter 2. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let's burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I'll make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You'll break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. pride will kill you because it takes your eyes off God and his goodness. Pride will kill you because it takes your eyes off who is really in charge. Pride will kill you because it puts you as the king of the castle. Pride says, I'm the king of the castle. And the Lord looks and he says, no, you're not. My son is. So go to him. If you've lifted up yourself against the Lord, if your life this week, this month, just your life, has been you toasting yourself at the end of every day to myself, if that is you, then you're in trouble. Because God is your judge. And he's the one that's really in charge. Pride takes you up, up, up. But the only way out of pride is to go down, 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 because that's where Jesus is. And Jesus is the real king. So kiss the Son. Kiss Jesus. Go to him. Worship him. Love him. Take refuge in him. That's the only way out of pride. And pride is ugly. And pride will kill you. What could that look like for us in Trinity? It's kind of a hard question, maybe. Like, what would these things look like for us in Trinity? What if as Trinity Chippenham we were like pridey? Well, the thing with pride, pride will kill you, but pride bites. Pride snarls. It bites each other. If we were a church that lived as kings of the castle, of our own castles, then we will rip each other apart. Because it's all about me, 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 and it's all about up, up, up. And I'm going to use you as a ladder to get higher. And if you're in the way on the ladder, I'm just going to rip you down. See, I'm at the front. And all of you, most of you, are looking at me and listening at me. So I'm probably quite important. I'm probably quite special. So I'm going to want to be at the front more often than anybody else, right? Because it's all about me. It's all about me being king of the castle. So if you're going to be at the front and I'm not, I'm going to, you know, maybe not to your face, maybe to other people. They're not quite as good at the front as me, are they? But it doesn't have to be people at the front. It can just be in kind of whatever situation, whatever the castle is in your life. It can be about having kids and someone not having kids. It can be being married and someone not being married. It can be kind of almost anything. Whatever that castle is, if we are pride people, if we are the kings of our own castles, pride will bite and it will snarl and it will rip and it will tear, and pride will kill us as a church. That's just the simple fact. Pride will kill us as a church. But what if Trinity, what if we were a church, a group of people, a family of people that kissed the Son? What if we were people who lived for Jesus? What if we were a group of people, individuals, but a group of people, a community of people, that in all of our lives, all of our energies, all of our focus and our time was given to living for Jesus, the real King? What would that be like? What would that be like for us as a church? Well, wouldn't we feel completely safe with one another? So there'd be no biting. I wouldn't have to hide anything from you so you can kind of bite me. But if I was really taking refuge in Jesus, then I would be happy to tell you about my weaknesses because you're not going to bite my head off. And you'd be happy to share your weaknesses because you know that I'm not going to bite your head off. We'd be completely safe with one another. We'd be quick to admit fault. We'd be quick to forgive. We would care. We would listen to each other, wouldn't we? We would come through those doors on a Sunday afternoon and we wouldn't need a mask. If we were people, if we were a church that kissed the Son, that took refuge in Jesus, we would celebrate each other. We would listen and we would care. We'd be safe. How does that sound? Does that sound like a good kind of church? Sounds all right, doesn't it? Sounds pretty good. Go to Jesus with your pride. Go to him with your up, 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 and your me, me, me. Go to him with your I'm the king of the castle. Just go to Jesus and give your everything to him and for him. Your energies and your plans, your hopes, your families, your paycheck, your not paycheck, your everything. Just live for him. Kiss the Son. Blessed are those who take refuge in him. Let's be a church. Let's be people who live for his kingdom. Let's say this week, he, Jesus, he is the captain of my life. He is the king of my castle. And he is so, so good. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we admit to you as we pray that we're not the people who we should be. We are people who are just so full of pride all the time, so much so that it just feels normal to us. It feels normal to us, Father, to live for me, me, me. It feels normal to climb the tree, to get to the top of the ladder, to the top of the castle. And yet, Father, you are the one who's really in charge. Your Son, Jesus, whom you love, is really the King. And I pray, Father, that your Spirit would have just been showing us our pride, and that's painful. But I pray that as he has done that, that also he is showing us what Jesus is really like, that you, Father, are a God who is good. You are a good, good Father who doesn't turn people away. We thank you that your Son is the real King, that he loves us and he is our brother, our Saviour, and that if we take refuge in him, we are completely safe, and we'll be completely safe with each other. Father, would we be a church here in Chippenham that live for you and in Jesus? Amen.